We're studying in the 16th chapter of Deuteronomy. Last time we'd gotten through the 15th verse of that chapter. And the subject has been the three feasts that they were to keep each year to the Lord. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. The last time we discussed those feasts in more detail, so tonight we will not enter into a discussion of those feasts. But in the 16th verse he says, three times in a year shall all thy males appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and in the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles. Now the interesting thing here is that all the males were to go to this place where the Lord would choose to put his name three times a year. And it makes you wonder how the rest of the country was managed to carry on the commerce and carry on the business of the country if all of the males that were able to and were of age to made this trip down eventually to the place of Jerusalem. But that's the way it teaches here, and I've not been able to find anything different from that. And we even find some evidence that some of the devout older women went. We studied the case where Joseph and Mary went yearly to the Feast of the Passover to Jerusalem. So this seems to be the not only the command, but also the practice. Another thing we'd like to notice is the interesting use of the number seven, or of sevens, as that God has made use of in the Old Testament. At the end of 7 days, there was a Sabbath day, a holy day. At the end of 7 weeks, there was a feast day, the Feast of Weeks. At the end of 7 months, there was a feast day, which was the Feast of Tabernacles. At the end of 7 years, there was this year of release. The land laid out that seventh year. Many things happened. Then at the end of a series of 7 years, which would be 49 years plus one, the year of Jubilee, the land went back to its original owner. So the series of sevens, and seven seems to be a number that is used over and over, and it seems to be a number that indicates some kind of completeness. Now, this is not all the use of sevens in the Bible by any means, but as we think of these feast days and these holy days, then the number seven does come to mind. In the last of verse 16, and they shall not appear before the Lord empty. Now, when they came, they were to bring something. They're bringing an offering to the Lord. They were not to appear empty. They were to bring something. Now, this was in addition to the tithes. You know, we had a couple of lessons back now about the tithing. And there was some question about whether or not it was one tithe a year, two tithes a year, or even some years three tithes. But we know there was at least one tithe, 10%. But in addition to that now, they brought something to these feasts. So it shall not appear before the Lord empty. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he hath given thee. So here we find a law about giving that's very similar to what we apply in the church age today. We give as we're able. We give according as we've been prospered. We give according as we purposed in our heart, according as the Lord has had blessed us. And that's exactly the way they gave here. In addition to their tithe, they came to the feast and did not come empty, but they came giving according to the blessing of the Lord thy God, which he hath given thee. Give as he's able. Now, there was no specified amount on this, no percentage as I understand it, but simply every person was put on his honor as to how much he would give, and he gave according to how well he considered the Lord had blessed him. So you see, this law of God has been functioning for a long time about you're going to be blessed. You're going to give in turn to God according to what you've been blessed, and then this in turn brings more blessings. And as it said in 2 Corinthians 9, he that soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, He that soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. And then he also said that God is able to sufficiently supply us according to every need. So we'll never give, if we're given a percentage, or if we're given according to the way we've been blessed, we'll never give enough to cause us to be broke or to cause us to be poor, because our percentage will always stay in the proper range with the way we've been blessed. And he's promised to bless us according to the way we give. Now, in the 18th verse, he takes up another subject. 18th verse of Deuteronomy 16. Judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. Now, while they were in the wilderness, Moses originally did all the judging, and then they set up a series of judges, where they had one over 10 and one over 100 and one over 1,000 and so on. But when they got into the land of Canaan and they had these cities and the gates, then they set up a system of judges according to their cities. And a city that had over 120 families had 23 judges, and a city lesser than that had as low as 3 judges. So he prescribes that here in this 18th verse. Judges and officers. Judges would be the ones who tried the cases, who passed the judgment, who decided what was right and what was wrong. The officers would be the ones who carried out the decision of the judges. Shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, throughout thy tribes. Now it seems that the Lord intended for them to have justice within easy reach. You know how it is among humankind when they're living in a system with no kind of judges or law. It's kind of like this country was when they had the so-called winning of the West. Every person wore a six-shooter. And if you got into a fight with somebody and somebody got killed, well, that was just too bad. And maybe there would be something done about it, maybe not. And it's a very great blessing to live in a place where there is law, where there is justice, where there are judges, and judgment can be carried out, and where there's some kind of peace and order. God intends for people to live under those type of circumstances. Now, we're talking about in the Old Testament here, we're talking about a situation where it was the kingdom of God's people, a holy kingdom set up by God, divinely ruled. And they had judges. Today, in our circumstance, we're living in worldly kingdoms, but still these governments and these authorities have been set up by God. They're ruling under the authority of God, carrying out the will of God. So it's a blessing to have law and order. It's a blessing to have judges. It's a blessing to have the ability to have wrongdoing brought to light and punishment rendered if it's needed or some corrective measure taken. And so we're going against all of God's intentions for mankind when we rebel against having some kind of law and order and authority. He intends that we have it. Otherwise, utter chaos. I was just thinking a few days ago how right here in this country, 150 years or so ago, the settlers who moved into this country, how they must have been rather brave and courageous people and tremendous hardships to have had at most any time to withstand an attack by Indians. Just think of being home. Any time they're at home, you might be surrounded by Indians, and your house might be burned, or your family might be carried away into captivity, or just a little journey down the road, and you might get caught by Indians. And we read story after story after story. Somebody out at the barn milking, and Indians come up and take them away. A terrible situation to have to live in because there was no law and order. But we have that now. God intended for his people to have it then. Now, as he talks about these judges, he says, they shall judge the people with just judgment. Thou shalt not rest judgment. Now, the word rest here means to stretch out or to turn aside. Do not distort judgment. Now, we're talking about a very difficult thing to define when you're talking about judgment, because it's not something that can be so easily put into words. It's doing the thing that's right, doing the thing that's proper. And we talk about justice. We want justice to be done. And we have to remember now that justice, not only does it exonerate and free the guiltless, but it also condemns and punishes the guilty. It's a double-edged sword. And a lot of times we're talking about let justice be done. We're talking about not punishing somebody who doesn't deserve to be punished. And we forget about justice also means that we do punish those who do deserve to be punished. We convict them of their misdeeds. So we said, thou shalt not rest judgment. Thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift. For a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. Now this is the way God intended for His kingdom to be run. This is the way He intended for His kingdom to have law and order and justice and judgment. Thou shalt not respect persons. Now this is most difficult. Not to respect persons. Very difficult. Little towns, or even big towns, the local people that are in good friends with the local law officials, they might be speeding a little bit, or they might run a red light, and they just, law official, let it go by, or maybe write a little warning ticket, but let a stranger pass through, and he's going to get the book thrown at him. Because they don't have to face him every week, they're not good friends, they don't drink coffee together or chum around together. And so it's difficult not to show respect to persons. But to really put out good judgment now is to not have any respect to persons. Another thing, thou neither take a gift. We're talking about somebody being, you know, paying off the law, which has been done, I guess, ever since this was written and before, because God recognized that it was a problem, and he legislated about it. When people who are in authority take gifts, that is, they take bribes, or they take favors, this automatically distorts their ability to show good judgment. And he spells it out here. Thou shalt not take gifts, for a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. If you have somebody who is wise, and you have somebody who is righteous, but if they take gifts, their eyes are blinded. The eyes of the wise are blinded. And the words of the righteous are perverted. They just cannot do it right if there are gifts involved, because these gifts are going to sway judgment. That's human nature. The Bible recognizes it, and God legislates about it. So as we look around about us today in our secular kingdom that we live in and the government that we live under, realizing that it's not a Christian or a godly government, even though God is the authority behind all governments, we can see how these forces are in play today. The officials who take gifts are going to be the corrupt ones. Even if they're wise men, even if they are in many points righteous men, they're going to be blinded and the words are going to be perverted, because they take gifts. And the Bible talks about it, and we've known this is true without even reading it from the Bible, but it's interesting to note that God talked about it way back there. Verse 20, that which is altogether just shalt thou follow, that thou mayest live and inherit the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now he was most emphatic about being just. Do the right thing. That which is altogether just wilt thou follow. And this was necessary, he says, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Necessary to keep the land, to keep this judgment, justice and judgment going. In verse 21, we have a different subject. Two more verses, a different subject. Thou shalt not plant thee a grove of any trees near unto the altar of the Lord thy God, which thou shalt make thee. Now God was so careful and so meticulous about not having them to be guilty of idolatry, not having them to mimic anything about idolatry, not to even look like idolatry, that he says, do not plant you a grove of any trees near the altar. As we know, the idolatrous people had groves that they worshiped their gods in, and they built their altar in these groves. These groves constituted a place for them to be secretive, and also a place to have a mystifying atmosphere. And so God didn't ever legislate this to be done in his worship. He did not want his worship to be like that. And so he didn't want his people to even act like they were worshiping like the idolaters worship. So he forbid them to plant any grove of trees near unto the altar of the Lord thy God. Now, other translations word this a little bit differently, and it's more interesting to me the way they word it. Instead of saying, not plant thee a grove of any trees, they say, no sacred pole and no wooden object whatsoever. Not to have any sacred pole nor any wooden object whatsoever. Others say, not to plant a tree, just a single tree. So, there wasn't to be any smattering of mimicry so far as idolatry goes, or the way that those people worship their gods. God did not want his people to mock that, to go after that, to be like that. The next verse, neither shall thou set thee up any image which the Lord thy God hateth. Now, this is very plain and emphatic language. There's no really great amount of interpretation as to go into understanding this. But it does make you greatly, greatly wonder today when you see persons who claim to be Christians, and the way that they worship, they have all manner of these images, all manner of these things that would violate this principle. They're worshiping just like the heathen would worship, only they've made it look like it's something that God would want them to do. So let's be very, very careful not to imitate, not to even look like that we're worshiping God in such a way that he has not authorized it. And if we talk about this pole, no sacred pole or wooden object whatsoever, it really, really makes me think about those who would erect a symbol of the cross. Because the word for cross in the New Testament does not necessarily mean something with a crossbar across it. It can just mean a stob, really. And Jesus is said to have been crucified on the tree. It does not have to have that cross member. So here again, we get into that something that's dangerously close to a pole when we're talking about erecting a cross. Now, going into the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy, beginning with the first verse, thou shalt not sacrifice unto the Lord thy God any bullock or sheep. Now, going into the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy, beginning with the first verse, thou shalt not sacrifice unto the Lord thy God any bullock or sheep wherein is blemish or any evil favoredness. For that is an abomination unto the Lord thy God. Talking about the worship to God, they were not to use anything that was inferior, anything that was not strictly according to the standard that he'd set up for his sacrifices. And, of course, the people were guilty of doing that. The prophets later on talk about them offering these animals that are inferior animals. But the principle here is that God wants the standard that he set for his worship to be maintained. And I think that we can aptly apply it today in our worship by realizing that God wants us to carry out the worship that we carry out today in such a manner that's consistent with what he's prescribed in the Bible. The things that he says about praying, and the things that he says about singing, the things that he says about communing, the things that he says about how to teach, those, the least we can do is follow what he says, not to violate what obviously has been said. And we find that when we follow what's been said, we don't have to add anything more because he said enough for us to carry out a satisfactory worship. And to pervert the worship by adding something, though we may think it's good, we may think it's appealing, we may like it, or by taking something away because we don't like to do it, by perverting the worship that way would simply be the same as offering up a bullock or a sheep wherein is blemish or evil favoredness. This is an abomination unto the Lord thy God. So let's be very careful to note then that God wants his worship to be done like he has stated for it to be done. And anything we do in our worship, nobody can come along and say, well, the Lord just didn't say about that. Really, what we do, there has been something said about it. In the second verse, if there be found among you within any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, whether it be in any of the cities, man or woman that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God in transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded. Now let's get the picture here. He's talking about those who would worship God in the wrong manner or who would worship idols. And so he said, if there be any within any of thy gates, a man or a woman that's done this. And he describes it by saying, that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God in transgressing his covenant. And I want to come back to this idea about the covenant now in just a minute. And hath gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven which I have not commanded. You know, it would seem like the most innocent thing that you could serve or pay any kind of homage or recognition to would be the moon or the sun or the stars, because it's very easy to rationalize these are such natural things. God has placed these here. Man hasn't touched or tarnished or had anything to do with them. They strictly come from nature. But he names those things as being things that are transgressing his covenant if we serve or worship them. And I would suppose that most cultures around the world have somehow or other intermingled in some of their beliefs the idea of recognizing and worshiping the heavenly bodies. The idea of the so-called followers of astrology and following these signs, that is, as paying some kind of homage, some kind of recognition to these powers. We're told in Jeremiah, the 10th chapter, not to be dismayed at the signs of heaven. Now, the heathen are. They're dismayed at these signs. They're really concerned and all so wrought up about it. We're not to let that have an effect on us. Well, if a man or woman does this, and it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquired diligently, and behold, it be true, and the thing certain, that such abomination is wrought in Israel, then thou shalt bring forth that man or that woman which have committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and shalt stone him with stones till they die. Now that's how God wanted that to be dealt with. Let's notice something about this. When you worship another god or give homage to another god or recognize some other power besides God in a spiritual realm, you have really broken your covenant with God. And that's what he says here, in transgressing his covenant. Now, some of the commands that we do, some of the commands that we transgress, we're transgressing a command, but we're not really breaking the covenant. I might tell a lie, or I might steal, but I can look up to my God and repent and get forgiveness. I've broken a command, but I'm still in covenant with my God. But if I appeal to another God, to another power, to another source spiritually than God, I've just said that I no longer recognize him as my God, and I'm taking something else as my God, even if it be for 5 minutes or 30 seconds. And that then breaks the covenant. It breaks the covenant. I had a person today make a statement and then knock on wood because he had some kind of a superstition that because he made that statement, if he didn't knock on wood and appeal to some power, that this thing then would be changed that he made a statement about. Had another person today that wouldn't pay $13 because he didn't believe in number 13. He paid $13 and a penny. Gave an extra penny because he was superstitious about the number 13. Where did we get this information? It doesn't come from God. God does not give us this information. We're appealing to another power when we do this. And we break the covenant with God. And it's just like a man and his wife. A husband and wife, they have an agreement between themselves about marriage. Well, there are wrong things that a man may do or that a woman may do. A man may not provide really like he should for his wife. He may fail to pay a bill here or there. He may not stop by the grocery store like she asked him to, and they have to have something else for supper. And then they get together and patch up their differences about it. But he hasn't challenged the marriage tie. He hasn't broken the covenant. But if he goes off with another woman and pays respect to another woman in the place of the wife, then that is a challenge to the covenant. That's a challenge to the marriage tie. And that's a whole offense of a different order. And so it is with God. We do other sins, but whenever we do something that challenges God as being our God, and we appeal to another source, we then are breaking the covenant. We're transgressing the covenant, the agreement that we have, that we'll be God's and he'll be ours. That agreement's being broken. And that falls in a different category of sin. A different category of problems. Those people were to be stoned to death. Now he says that it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquired diligently. It's not a matter of just taking some hearsay. You inquire diligently. And behold, it be true, and the thing certain. No question about it. It's not just hearsay evidence. It is a certain thing that such abomination is wrought in Israel. And thou shalt bring forth that man or woman which have committed that wicked thing under thy gates. Now that's where the punishment was carried out there at the gates, in public and in open, and everybody knew about it. Even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones till they die. Now we have another principle involved here too in verse 6. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death. Now this has been a principle that God's had for a long time. Two or three witnesses. It seems that you can have two or three people who have each witnessed something as a separate individual to then bear witness that they did see it and they do verify that it happened. That this is evidence enough in the eyes of God. One witness is not enough. Two or three. Now, this principle was followed by Jesus Christ whenever he taught about problems in the church. And if you wouldn't hear one, he says, take two or three. Again, we have the Apostle Paul talking in 2 Corinthians 13. When he came and he was coming to Corinth and he was wanting to set in order those things that were wrong, he says, at the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. Timothy, in writing about the bishops, he says, accept not an accusation against an elder except before by two or three witnesses. So this is a principle throughout the Bible. Two or three witnesses. One witness is not enough. We have to consider the word of one person, really, hearsay evidence, so far as acting or taking a stand that's going to cause us to act. But two or three witnesses, this gets close to the point then that of meeting all the requirements that God has. Well, he goes on and says, the hands of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hands of all the people, so shalt thou put the evil away from among you. So those who were witnesses, those who were so sure, so positive, and willing to testify, there were the ones who were the first of all cast the stones, and then the others could cast the stones. And it reminds us of the story of Jesus, who had the woman brought to him who'd been caught in adultery. And they were wanting the woman to be stoned to death. And Jesus told him to go ahead. As him is without sin, cast the first stone. Because if they were going to fully apply that law, and they were going to cast the first stone, if they were guilty of the same thing, then they too should be stoned to death. And the crowd slowly disappeared. He began writing something in the dirt. And this same principle here. Now, that seemed like a real harsh thing. But this person had broken God's covenant. Was no longer considered to be in the family of God. He had turned to another God to save him. And this is the way God intended for wickedness of this nature to be put away. Now, beginning in the 8th verse, we go back to the subject of the judges again. If there arise a matter too hard for thee in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, and between stroke and stroke, being matters of controversy within thy gates, then thou shalt arise and get thee up into the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. Now we have a situation of the judges that have been set up in each one of these cities. They're functioning, but here comes a matter that's too hard for thee in judgment. A matter too hard to judge. Now that tells us several things. One is, we learn that it's no disgrace for a judge to say, I'm not qualified to try this case. This one's too complicated for me to pass judgment upon. My experience does not lend enough wisdom for me to be able to do justice to this problem. A matter, he says, too hard for thee in judgment. Then he names the different kinds of cases it could be. Between blood and blood, where somebody had actually attacked another person and brought blood, and it probably even means death here. Somebody has killed someone. And maybe they've been another death in retaliation. And between plea and plea. Now this would be just where there was a dispute between two people. And one was pleading that it should be one way and one another way. And the third thing is in between stroke and stroke. And that would be an assault and battery case. Some physical violence involved. Being matter of controversy within thy gates. It happened here within our jurisdiction. Within thy gates, but it's too hard for me to judge. Then he said, thou shalt arise and get thee up into the place which the Lord thy God shall choose, which we know was originally the tabernacle, and eventually it was Jerusalem where the temple was. And thou shalt come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire. And they shall show thee the sentence of judgment. Well, we know that the priests of Levites, all the priests were of the Levites. They could go to the priest with it. Now, the priest, you know, was a man of God. He was a man that should have a lot of wisdom, a lot of ability to judge. He was very close to the Lord. He was close to the matters that had to do with the word of the Lord. And so anything that the Lord had legislated about, he should be able to have a fair judgment about. But he said you could go to the priest, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days. Now, when they got into the land of Canaan, they had a system of judges where they had one judge that seemed to be a predominant judge. And these were people like Samson and Deborah and Samuel. There was 400 years of these judges. And so it might be a matter that you wouldn't go to the priest with, but you might go to the judge, the top judge in the land, and let this person decide about it. But somehow or other they went to one of these sources, maybe both. Maybe it had to be handled by both. And inquire. That is, you bring the question to them. And they shall show thee the sentence of judgment. Now, these people would give you a sentence. They would pass judgment. You've gone to the top, and the top passed judgment. Be quite a sobering position now to be one of those judges. Or quite a sobering position to be one of those priests. Knowing that here was a matter too hard for the local people to take care of, and you have to pass on it, and what you say is law. This is not a farce, the way God had it set up. It's not a matter to try, and then somebody's going to overthrow that judgment, and they try it again, and somebody else to overthrow that, and they try it again, and first, here they are, they're innocent, then they're guilty, then they're innocent. It's not that way. Whenever these people at the top, whenever they pass judgment, that was it. Because it says in verse 10, and thou shalt do according to the sentence which they of that place which the Lord shall choose shall show thee. And thou shalt observe to do according to all that they inform thee. Whatever the sentence was, do it. You've turned it over into their hands, now you carry out the sentence. According to the sentence of the law which they shall teach thee, and according to the judgment which they shall tell thee, thou shalt do. Thou shalt not decline from the sentence which they shall show thee, to the right hand, nor to the left. You couldn't back off. You couldn't change. You couldn't alter it. Whatever the sentence was, whatever the judgment was, that you do. Do not decline to the right hand, nor to the left. Now, as we think of right hand and left, we think of conservative versus those that are not conservative. And I don't know if this has reference to that or not, but you could change it more conservatively, or you could change it and make it a harsher sentence. But you're not to change it. It's not to be altered at all. And one of the things that's interesting to me when he talks about the sentence of the law which they shall teach thee, uses the word teach there, as though it'd be a learning process for you. And according to the judgment which they shall tell thee. So you're taught something and you're told something. Thou shalt do. Verse 12, and the man that will do presumptuously and will not hearken unto the priest that standeth to minister there before the Lord thy God, or unto the judge, even that man shall die. And thou shalt put away the evil from Israel. Now, the one who would not let this sentence be carried out on him, he's going to rebel against it. He wouldn't abide by the sentence. That man should die. They didn't take that any further. Not going to follow through with the judgment. not of the sentence, not going to submit to the law of the court, you die. Now he says that the man will do presumptuously. You know, they had back then a presumptuous sin and a sin of ignorance. The presumptuous sin, there was no sacrifice offered for that. But the sin of ignorance, sacrifice was offered for forgiveness. And as I looked up this word presumptuous, try to see what it means, it really means pride. To do something with pride. You're so haughty, you're so proud, that you will not be humbled by the sentence. You refuse to humble down and follow the sentence. If he doesn't follow it, that man shall die. Now this reminds us of the teaching given in the New Testament, in Hebrews the 10th chapter, where he refers back to this law of Moses. He says in verse 26 of Hebrews 10, "For if we sin willfully after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sins." Sound like a presumptuous sin, see, no more sacrifice. "But a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation, which shall devour the adversaries. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. Of how much sore punishment, suppose ye, shall he be thought worthy who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God, and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing, and hath done despite under the Spirit of grace." So he refers there in Hebrews 10 back to the law of Moses. And he died without mercy if he despised Moses' law. Of how much sore punishment are we going to have today if we trample underfoot the Son of God? So we have a worse punishment in store for us than they had for them. Not only do we have no more sacrifice for sins, the punishment is worse. There remains no more sacrifice. It's a presumptuous sin, a sin of pride. And then in verse 13 he says, "And all the people shall hear and fear and do no more presumptuously." Now what they're supposed to do as a result of this, as a result of this being put to death, stoning death at the gates, they were to hear it and fear. The purpose was to bring about in the minds of the people a certain amount of fear. They saw that God would not tolerate this kind of behavior. They saw that God would not tolerate a presumptuous violation of His will and of His law. And consequently, it was to bring fear into them. And certainly, this principle would have to be effective today. Now, the modern-day criminologist says that it doesn't work. That you can punish a wrongdoer, and it doesn't keep anybody else from doing anything wrong. But according to the Bible, when the people see this kind of punishment, it instills a fear into them so that they will do no more presumptuously. That is, it does away with this pride, this rebellion, this haughtiness, and it enables them to better humble themselves because they do not want to be involved in being put to death. So God had some very wise and sound principles here, principles that are still in effect today if governments would only apply them as God would have them applied. And He intended His people follow law and order and justice. We can see that that's intended. And even today in the church, we still have law and order and justice in the church. It is to be followed. And we have the Bible as our guide. And we're even told in 1 Corinthians that if we have a matter there that needs to be judged, not to go before the law of the land, but we pick out wise men among ourselves and let them help settle the dispute. Well, we're so close to the end of our time.